I think it's outrageous that anybody, Republican or Democrat, should even think that the government should be shut down for months.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and author of the Politico Playbook. This week, we're doing something a little different. Why? We're on day 19 of the government shutdown, the second longest shutdown in U.S. history. We're going to bring you an inside-outside conversation about the impact the shutdown is having on women.
They have children to raise. They have children to send to school. They have food to buy.
That's Representative Nita Lowey from New York. She's the first House Appropriations Committee chairwoman, which has the power of the purse, and she's trying to find a way to open the government back up.
So the president should be an adult and talk to Nancy Pelosi, Senator Schumer, and the other leadership that are going to be there and pass the options we gave him. It is so easy to do.
We also sat down with Dr. Petrina M. Clark, president and founder of Pivotal Practices. She's a former longtime government worker who now owns a government contracting business and tells us about the real-life impact the shutdown is having on her and her business.
See, sadly, there's no such thing as insulation. You know, if you're a government contractor, then there's just really no way to insulate yourself from these kinds of disruptions.
Women Rule is produced in partnership with our founding partners, Google and the Tory Burch Foundation. Here's Nita Lowey. I want to jump right in. Shutdown. Do you see a solution in sight at all?
I think there was a solution the first day when Nancy Pelosi presented the appropriations, really the, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, a very positive, meaningful appropriations recommendation. And that was to take six bills that passed either the full Senate or the Senate Appropriations Committee and pass that immediately, and then take the bill that's causing all the problems, the Homeland Security bill, and give it a month on a continuing resolution. To me, that made sense. You had the six bills that passed most of the Senate, and we would have time to have a healthy debate about the issue that is causing so many problems.
But yet, we have no deal. There's a lot of talk coming out of the White House about a potential border wall for a funding for a DACA deal. Is that something you would support?
Look, I think we have to open the government. There has to be a serious discussion. As far as I'm concerned, at the ports of entry, we have to be really worried about all the opioids that are coming over. If you look at the Homeland Security bill, they're talking about many remedies that cost money. And I think everything should be on the table. And if the president would stop talking about his wall, I think we can come to an agreement.
So are you optimistic that there might be a deal in the next week or so? Or there's some of your Republican counterparts who are saying this could go on for months?
I think it's outrageous that anybody, Republican or Democrat, should even think that the government should be shut down for months. So the president should be an adult and talk to Nancy Pelosi, Senator Schumer, and the other leadership that are going to be there and pass the options we gave him. It is so easy to do. I want to repeat again, the six bills that we want to pass until September 30th and then leave the one bill where there are questions for 30 days to discuss options. That's the way it should happen.
I want to talk about the impact of the shutdown. This is a podcast kind of for and about women. Do you think a shutdown impacts women more than men? Certainly in this one where you have programs, you know, for HUD, for example, a lot of families of lower income families are headed by women. What's the impact there?
This has a very, very powerful impact on women and families around the country. As you know, it's thrilling to have 100 women in the Congress now. And they were talking just this morning at our meeting about what it's doing in the community. There are two women from Indian reservations. They were talking about their personal experiences. People all over the country are suffering. When 800,000 people are not getting a paycheck, And many of these families are headed by women. They have children to raise. They have children to send to school. They have food to buy. They have drugs to purchase, which are more expensive than ever. So this has an enormous impact on women.
Talk about your time in New York politics. You've been there for a long time, since the 70s. What's your relationship like with the president? He's obviously running kind of New York political circles for a long time. Do you know his family?
I went to Mount Holyoke, and his sister was a good friend of mine at Mount Holyoke, and she is now a judge in senior status. I was very friendly with Marianne Trump, and she was a hard worker, excellent student, and if she were not a smoker and spent most of her time in the smoker, we would have spent more time together. I never really knew Donald Trump much. I lived in one of the Fred Trump, his father's building. It was an apartment house. In fact, Marianne lived right in the next apartment. But I never knew Donald Trump very well.
And have you had much interaction with him since he's become president?
Not any interaction with him.
Well, that could certainly change in your new role.
Maybe. We'll see if he wants to talk and talk facts and talk about appropriations. I'd be delighted to work with him.
You are wearing a Madam Speaker button on your blazer, your suit today. Nancy Pelosi is back as Speaker. She was the first woman Speaker. How important to you was it that she get back in that role?
Nancy Pelosi has been and will be an outstanding Speaker of the House. First of all, I served with her on appropriations, Roger Laura, Nancy Pelosi, and I. So we go back quite a bit. She is a strong leader. She understands and is concerned about families. This is why dealing with the cost of prescription drugs has been such a key issue. The Affordable Care Act, where she took the lead. And I remember working with her as many groups were trying to influence her. And she was strong, but very sensitive and very upset with the kind of criticism that she was getting.
So you mentioned the number of women that are in the 116th Congress. There's more women, more diversity. What impact do you think that is going to have this year?
As I get to know one by one, and I've been trying to meet with every one of the new members, I am so impressed. It is extraordinary. Number one, you're looking at their past experience, their educational background. They've served in the military. One of them that I was talking to was in charge. I'm not sure if she was an admiral, but she was in charge of a whole ship. But they are so skilled, so diverse in their experience that I get the feeling I have a lot to learn from each and every one of them. They come to me and they want to know how I became head of the Appropriations Committee, and I said I worked hard, and I'd be happy to have further discussions with them on it. But they add so much to our Democratic caucus, and I look forward to learning from them.
One of the freshmen who's gotten a lot of buzz about her, it comes from your own delegation, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Have you gotten to know her at all?
I certainly called her in. I met with her for about an hour. We talked about health care. We talked about constructive issues. And I think it was a very positive meeting. She has a million followers. I don't know if I'll ever get a million followers. But She ran a very aggressive campaign. She was actually born and raised in Yorktown Heights, which is in my district. And she ran, of course, in Queens, mm-hmm. and I represented a lot of Queens. My district has been changed 3 times since I got here.
So let's talk a little bit about the historic nature that you are involved with. This committee, the Appropriations Committee, the power of the purse, has existed since after the Civil War. And you are the first woman to head it. And now you have a ranking member who is a woman, Kay Granger, on the Republican side. And the top 2 staffers on the committee are also women. You have kind of a revolution inside your own Appropriations Committee happening right now. What impact does that have? Can you talk about what that means to you?
Well, the Appropriations Committee, as you know, is consists of 12 subcommittees. And the reason it's so exciting for me to be chair is I try to understand every one of the bills. And I need roller skates on. I have my sneakers on, but I think I need roller skates. Because although we try to not have the same hearing at the same time and place, I try to attend to all of them. And what's been interesting to me, although I am chair of the Foreign Ops Subcommittee, and I have responsibility for that bill, I feel and take it very seriously. I have responsibility of all the bills. And I have an excellent staff. Before any bill goes to a hearing or goes to the floor, I am briefed in depth on every bill.
Do you think it makes any difference, or what's your relationship like with Kay Granger, just to have two women kind of in the ranking and the chair role?
We have a very positive relationship. We have a very friendly relationship, and I'm very pleased, and I hope that continues. But that doesn't mean when her leadership directs her to include something in a bill, she is responsible to her leadership. And that often is disappointing to me. But it was the same way when I was dealing with Hal Rogers on foreign operations. So I've dealt with Kay Granger on foreign operations, appropriations bill, and I've dealt with Hal Rogers. It's always disappointing to me because I always think if I'm right, I can convince anybody with reason. I think that's the way women often operate. You know, we do our research, we do our homework, and I always think I can convince other colleagues who may not agree with me of my position. But unfortunately, what I have found is when you're dealing with the Republicans on the issue like choice, family planning, they have their point of view, and no matter how thoughtful I am, I can't change their mind.
There's been a lot of discussion about bringing earmarks back, trying to find some way to get more members to support some of those tough votes on spending bills. Is there a way to do earmarks that can be responsible and not abuse the system?
I love that question because we are Article 1, and we have a right to have member-directed, I'll call it earmark, member-directed earmarks. And way back when David Obey was chair, we had a process in place where we created a responsible list of questions so that we would ensure there would be no private interest in this entity. And I think there is a way to do it. Now, I think it's important that we understand the needs of every member of Congress, especially the new members. Whether there are specific earmarks or not, we ask them to submit their priorities. And on many issues, you can address their priorities even without earmarks. But I would be supportive of earmarks, and I'm not sure how that is going to resolve itself.
So are you optimistic that they will come back this Congress?
Glad we're not on TV to take a picture of me. let me just say again, I support understanding members' priorities. As a chair, and even before as the ranking member, I always listen carefully, try and meet with every member, try to address their priority. And I would be supportive of bringing back earmarks with all the controls that we have put on them in the past. I think it's very important that we evaluate the request. They are consistent with all the rules. Right. But I'm not sure because the Republicans, it has to be bipartisan, and the Republicans have been very much against them.
Speaking about funding priorities, Democrats have very different funding priorities than Republicans. Right now, there's a $780 billion deficit, and some of your colleagues are talking about doing things with more social spending. How do you think, when you have a good economy but already have a huge deficit and a potential economic slowdown looming, you can kind of reconcile those things?
First of all, I think we have to remember that the deficit grew tremendously as a result of the Trump tax cut. many of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle don't want to acknowledge that. But there are issues that are bipartisan. There are challenges that are bipartisan. Certainly infrastructure needs. I know in my district, and I hear this from my colleagues, the roads, the bridges, the highways are in terrible shape. And I would be very supportive of a major infrastructure bill. How we actually structure it, how we get input from the Republicans, I think there could be real strong bipartisan support for an infrastructure bill. And there are many plans out there. There's an infrastructure bank that I think it was Rosa DeLauro who, I think it was her bill, I'm not sure, but an infrastructure bank. So there are many ways to structure the program so that it wouldn't add to the deficit. There could be public-private partnerships. There is agreement among Democrats and Republicans that investing in infrastructure is absolutely essential.
Before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on potential Democratic candidates in the 2020 race. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, one of the kind of favored names out there for somebody who will probably put her hat in the race. Anybody who you're supporting, you would like to see run?
I am not supporting anybody. I know Joe Biden well, and I know he's thinking about running. He has the experience, and he certainly has the demeanor to run a campaign. But there are so many good candidates. You look at Kamala Harris. You look at Kirsten Gillibrand. There are so many out there that I am going to reserve judgment until I see the field. And I have a feeling there are going to be a healthy number of candidates running. And I know that I'm just going to work very, very hard because we have got to take back the White House. Going through this appropriations process with President Trump has been so irresponsible. And as the news tells me, I don't remember if I read it in Politico or someplace else, that he watches TV until about 11 o'clock, then he comes down. You need a president that works in partnership with Democrats and Republicans. We have to open the government now and deal with the serious challenges, both domestically and internationally. I'm very concerned about the populist movement that is gaining strength all through Europe. We have to strengthen, not weaken, our relationship with our allies. A president has to have in-depth knowledge. The number of people, most recently Secretary Mattis, that has left is very depressing to me. You need people who are experts, both internationally and domestically, that can work in partnership with the Congress. And again, my role is to work with all 12 subcommittees, both addressing issues internationally and domestically. But you need people working with the president who understand what they're doing. And it is very depressing to me that the most skilled people are just leaving, headed by Secretary Mattis, one by one by one. So I hope we can get through and elect a Democrat for 2020. I look forward to speaking and hearing from each of them. And it's essential in my judgment that we win that election. So I intend to be active. I intend to work closely, whoever the person is that comes out of the primary.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a delight meeting you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Now, my conversation with Patrina Clark. Well, Dr. Clark, thank you so much for joining me on the Women Rule podcast. The government is going into its third week of a shutdown with no end in sight. I wanted to get your sense of the impact of the shutdown on women, on men. Is there any difference?
So I don't think necessarily that there's a difference in terms of the shutdown itself, but certainly to the extent that there are already some variances that are disproportionately impacting women, then they're going to continue to feel that disproportionately during the shutdown.
And what's your sense? I mean, we're in Washington. I work in the Capitol most days. It's very easy to think about this as a political fight, and it's just kind of Republicans versus Democrats. But what are some of those real world impacts that you know, we're kind of starting to just see?
You know, we're seeing stories about people who they're going to miss their first paycheck in a few days, and that's going to be the real impact. I saw letters or stories about letters going out asking landlords to be more lenient. So there are some real world impacts here. I was probably most saddened in terms of the coverage. I think on Saturday I saw this 71-year-old female janitor who was a contract employee who had been furloughed. And the issue for contract workers is while federal employees very likely will receive pay for the time that they're out, these government contractors who've been told not to come to work until the shutdown is resolved are not going to get back pay. So this is time spent with real money loss. So there's real implications here for the non-feds in particular.
You also have your own business. You women own business. You do federal contracting. What are you doing? Are you kind of insulated? Have you tried to, you know, insulate yourself from this kind of a situation?
See, sadly, there's no such thing as insulation. You know, if you're a government contractor, then there's just really no way to insulate yourself from these kinds of disruptions. And that's really what they are. They're disruptions to continuity. Thankfully, about half of my revenue is with agencies who have appropriations, but the other half are not. And I've actually had work paused. And so that does give me some cause and concern. Short term, it's certainly manageable, but longer term, it does have real implications. I had several colleagues during the last shutdown who, you know, were just one contract away from going out of business. And a couple of them actually did close their businesses and transition to doing something else. And it was a shorter shutdown than even this one. So even seemingly short term shutdowns have real lasting implications that have ripple effects that amplify with each passing day.
I mean, is there, when you're getting these contracts, I mean, we've been lurching from government shutdown to government shutdown, but clearly this is the second longest in history by the end of Monday night. And then if there's no seemingly end in sight, do you have any kind of contingencies, or are you going to try to pick up other work in the meantime?
Sadly, contracting doesn't really work that way. You know, there are long lead times. It's a sales process. And so there are really long lead times in these sales processes. And so I think beyond the contracts that firms like my own already have, there were these opportunities that were in process, you know, in the sales pipeline that are now indefinitely put on pause. And so contingencies are always working your sales pipeline. But if your sales pipeline is choked off, then there's, you know, you just have to start all over again. So there's really no short-term solution. And I think kind of going back to your earlier question about disparate impact to women. You know, we know women in business have a more difficult time with access to capital. And so in situations like this, short-term loans are usually what people look to serve as bridges. But if there are already challenges with accessing capital, then that's just going to be more difficult, because whatever the barriers and constraints are to limiting or reducing access to capital for women, it becomes exponentially more so during uncertain times. Because, I mean, you're taking a loan on the idea that you'll be able to pay it back. And if you're basing your ability to pay it back on your government contracting business, but there's no government contracting, then you're likely not to get a loan. So it's definitely very disconcerting. And so it would be wonderful if our government were able to work better together on issues like this. As a longtime Fed, I just marveled at how the budget process was almost like Groundhog Day. You know, it just kept repeating itself.
And these are not deadlines, or it's not like it's coming from out of nowhere,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. It happens the same time every year. And so it does get, I get the idea of having multiple voices in the perspective. It's a lot of money. And so it's important for our elected representatives to do their best to make sure that they're representing their respective constituencies, and then trying to balance that against the ideal of the greatest possible good. So I definitely understand the challenge. I just wish there were a way that we could do that in a way that at least felt more collegial and collaborative, so that when our elected representatives make statements that, you know, this is necessary because, you know, we're really endeavoring to collaborate and collegially work this out, then I think there would be more understanding and more support. It just gets to be very disheartening when it appears that that's not the way that the issues are being resolved.
I want to back up a little bit and talk about how you got here. You mentioned many years in government service. You have quite a backstory. You worked for 25 years in five federal agencies.
Yes.
The USGAO, the FEC, the Department of the Navy, the VA, and the IRS.
Yes.
Did I get them all right?
You did get them all right.
Good. You went from that kind of bulk of service in the public sector to entrepreneurship to the private sector. What made you make the jump?
Candidly, I had been talking about the importance of authentic living for probably a decade or so at the time. And I had become increasingly, I don't know how I would describe it, maybe less passionate about public service. When I started, I was just, you know, all guns a-blazing, public service, just the oath of office. Every time I took it, it just, something in my spirit just leapt. And after, you know, my last 7 or 8 years in federal service, it just increasingly felt less and less that way. And I wasn't really sure what the nexus was, but I knew that I was the common denominator. And the seeming disconnect between passion, purpose, and self was, and what I was actually doing was creating some real physical stress for me. And so I made a self-preservation kind of decision to take care of self and also walk my talk. And it's interesting because I didn't have a plan at the time other than I knew I just had to do something else. And so I took a pause and reevaluated and then started as a solopreneur. Thankfully, you know, my federal career led me to some interesting opportunities fairly soon after I made the decision to leave government. And that gave me some additional time to really kind of reflect and think about, okay, do I pursue this public private sector, public sector, mm-hmm. you know, what is it exactly mm-hmm. I should be doing? And I don't know that I was that intentional about the next steps. I just sort of continued to kind of go with the flow. And then 7 years later, you know, here I sit again, kind of reevaluating like next steps.
I always say, yeah, I walk into the Capitol every day. And when I'm on the Hill, and the minute it doesn't feel special anymore is the minute it's time to really think about doing something else with your life or kind of pivoting like you have to maybe stay involved, but in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's a great perspective. And I appreciate your saying that because I still get goosebumps when I see the Washington Monument. I moved here in 97. Well, I came here on a temporary detail. And I even just telling you, I get goosebumps. I'm feeling goosebumps. But seeing the Washington Monument, the Capitol, and I periodically just walk those monuments and think about the sacrifices that went into erecting them and establishing and fortifying this democracy. And I still feel very passionately about doing whatever I can to support that continuing evolution of what I believe to be the greatest country on earth.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our show is produced by Jenny Ament. Our booker is Jessica Andrews. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter at @APalmerDC. You can join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866.